This is part three of the Extension Service Oral History Interview with Len Calvert. Today is August 24th. Len, to start today, could you talk about the work that you did with the Extension Service? I don't know if you could talk about a typical day, or maybe talk about some of the projects you worked on and some of the areas and so forth.
Yeah. I'm not sure if there's a typical day, necessarily. I was hired in the beginning to write news releases. I mean, that was what we did, to extend knowledge through the mass media. That was the goal. As time went on, things were added, things changed. One of the things that changed was that I think I was probably the first one in the office to do this. In the 60s, the U.S. Department of Agriculture started a program called Rural Areas Development, and each state was involved, and we had a statewide committee, and J.W. Scheel, who was then an assistant director, picked me up, and I had to go to the meetings and with my tape recorder and record them all. And then I wrote a newsletter called, I don't remember what it was called, anyway, about rural areas development. And that was the first time I'd done something like that. Then later, several years later, we changed and we became, instead of trying to produce a lot of stuff, the information specialist became communication specialist, and we did more consulting, and I started out working with agriculture and a little bit with 4-H. Then it changed, and I was put in charge of, if you want to put it that way, information work with 4-H and home economics. And that was fun. I wrote news releases, I gave advice on how to do things, and all along, from the very beginning, I forgot, was the role of the specialist was to educate the county agents. And so we would do training out about the state on how to write news releases, how to take news photographs, and also radio, which was important at that time, less important now. In fact, I'm not sure anybody in Extension does radio anymore. Then later on, it broadened again. I was still writing news releases, but I was also doing a lot of other things, like developing slideshows, which I not done before, about program areas. I did one about home economics, one about 4-H. The home ec one, I was really pleased with it because it was used in some classes in the School of Home Economics.
You know, at OSU?
Yeah, later.
Did you take the photos or the slides for those?
Some of them. Other people in the office took slides also. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting experience because one of the things we did was take pictures of children, young children, at a preschool or a daycare center. And we had to develop a permission slip to send home with every kid so we could take their pictures. Mm. You know, we didn't identify where the daycare center was or who, you know, any of them were, but we still had to do that. Parents are concerned that the other parent, or you know, if they were divorced, that and the non-custodial parent knew where the child was, you know, this can cause problems in that age. And so that was sort of different. Then I got a grant one time I can't remember, from State Department of Education, I think. To do education over television. And what we did was produce six or eight half-hour videos on food preservation, which were shown on OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting, two or three times over, you know, 2 or 3 years, and on two or three commercial stations, but I don't remember. Medford seems to stick in my mind, but I'm not sure that's true. One of the things that also occurred...
Well, for these videos then, did you do the taping, or you were
no,
the
script? No, I was the producer.
The producer, okay, yeah.
No, we had a man in our office who did the filming, Bill Smith, who retired after 30 years with Extension or whatever it was. He was a 4-H agent in Clackamas County and then came to campus to do radio with KOAC. KOAC is the forerunner of what's now called Oregon Public Broadcasting, and Oregon State had the license, you know, for KOAC. And Extension used to do at least an hour, almost an hour a day on KOAC, about farm markets, interviews with the specialists and so forth, you know, like that. And Bill did that. Arnold Ebert did it first, and then Bill Smith. And
were you involved in producing those two?
No, I didn't do anything with radio. Bill did all that. Then let's see, where was I going? Oh, I know.
I interrupted.
As part of the whole thing, particularly working with the subject matter areas, 4-H and Home Ec, I got involved with the Oregon Extension Homemakers Council, and I did some workshops for them on writing. I wrote with Alberta Johnson the brochures for the Mini College for Homemakers. Then I was asked to do more work with the College of Agriculture, and got very involved with agricultural conference days. I was one of the planners, and then we prepared press kits. I mean, this was very sort of elaborate. I also did that early on with the Oregon Horticultural Society. I had Hort as responsibility in the early days, and in those days, a lot of agricultural organizations met at Oregon State. They don't do that anymore, but in those days they did. And Hort Society was a big one. And the first year I did it, you know, I sort of was trying to figure out what was going on. And then I got to the point where I was preparing news releases about most of the speakers before the meetings, and we would send them out for release that day or, you know, whatever. That was a lot of work, but it was sort of fun. And I got acquainted with a lot of growers and specialists and researchers that probably I wouldn't have interacted with.
For someone who doesn't know anything, what's the difference then between the agricultural conference days and the horticultural society conferences?
Okay. The Oregon Horticultural Society is exactly what it sounds like. It was fruit growers, vegetable growers, you know, nursery crops. Ag conference days, agricultural conference days, was sponsored by the College of Agriculture. And I'm not quite sure. In a way, it was sort of a public relations thing. You know, it was a way of spotlighting some major donors of money to the college. It was a way of offering people a chance to present information. There were dinners. You know, the big dinner was held in Gill Coliseum. which is a big space. Mm-hmm. One of the things, the first or second year I did a conference days, was also the 75th anniversary of the college. Or as it was known then, it was the School of Agriculture, and in the 75th year of the school, it became the College of Agriculture, and it was the first school at Oregon State to become a college. You know, nobody else had done that yet. Now, I think everybody's at college. And that was also when Dean Brisky started what became known as the Diamond Pioneer Awards. And these are people 75 and 74 and older who've made significant contributions to agriculture, their communities, to Oregon State. It recognizes leadership, I guess you could say. And that program is continuing. And every year I do the news releases about the people being recognized. I still do that. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Then it extended more into you served on a lot of committees for extension during, you know, almost all the specialists did. We had an annual conference every year, which brought everybody who worked for extension came to campus, you know, for 3 or 4 days. I was on those two or three times. I was co-chair of the 75th anniversary committee for extension's 75th anniversary. With Barb Saar, who was a 4-H specialist. You sort of did all these things. Mm-hmm. And then it became a little more political when we started working with Extension Service Districts, the creation of Extension Service Districts. Because after the first one, I gave some advice to the person who was working with him on the Crook County one, which was the first one in the state. And then I became Dick Craig, who was, what was Dick's title by then? Was he business manager or something? He and I became the team that got sent to the counties considering extension service districts to help them. You know, Dick was very good about the law and that they had to follow and things like that, where I was coming along with, you've got to organize a committee to do this, the agent can't do that.
So this was the organizing after the elections were?
No, before.
Oh, before.
Before the elections.
Okay.
And we were always lucky in that the county commissioners could declare a service district. I mean, they could just simply say, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And the people could always say, no, we want to vote on it. And Lincoln County did that. They were the only county, I think, that I know of that did that. But then the service district that they established was not activated for a few years because the county budget got better or something. And so it wasn't necessary. But then it became necessary to activate the district. And what you were voting on then, what people were voting on, was really to establish a tax base for the district. They could always appeal. And we only went through two elections on that, and that was in Curry County. I could be snide and say the retirees and rookies didn't have enough to do. But they decided that they would appeal this, and so we had to have two elections, one to establish the district mm-hmm. and one to establish the tax base. And unfortunately, they came very close together. I mean, they were within a month, 6 weeks, I mean, it was, I can't remember now exactly the time frame, but they were very close. And so what you had to do was figure out how you were going to do this. And one of the things, you know, to, because you had two elections coming very close together. And one of the things we did was develop a bumper sticker that said, yes, yes. Well, I, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
You know, that seemed to be the best solution, which implied, you know, you're going to vote yes twice. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult because the agents, by law, could not advocate. You know, they could offer information, but they could not advocate for a yes vote or a no vote. I mean, you know, that simply wasn't done, or it couldn't be done. And even so, you still had some people, like in Wheeler County, the ag agent was out explaining things, and he got criticized a couple times because people thought he was, you know, urging yes votes. And he really wasn't trying to do that. He was trying to do what he was supposed to do. And so it's a very delicate line that everybody walks, you know. And I was successful until Morrow County, which I think we've talked about before.
So you must have done a lot of traveling then throughout the state.
Yeah. It was one memorable trip. It was agent training, and H. Joe Myers, who was then state 4-H leader, and I went together, and we did four or five regional workshops for 4-H agents on communication and writing, and those were good sessions. I felt good about them. I actually found a movie to use, which was an old black and white movie, but it was very good. And it was really about, it was supposed to be about writing business letters, but it really fit, you know, what we were talking about, you know, how you communicate with people. And I always remember him saying, one of the things I always remember was, if you were going to say yes immediately. You know, if somebody asks you to do something, oh yes, I'm happy to do that. But if you were going to say no, you start out and you lay out all the reasons before you actually say no. Huh. You know, I don't have time, you know, I have previous commitments, you know, and so forth and so on. And so therefore I can't do this. Which I always thought was sort of an interesting approach to things. And it was fun. I always, agent training was always a chore. Well, I shouldn't say that. It was always challenging, let's put it that way. I had fun doing it. I mean, well, fun may not be the right verb or noun, but it was part of the job, and it had great rewards at times. And there were some agents who would send me things to look at, you know, and critique. And this one man, I remember him so well. He didn't write well, but he tried and tried. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was just, it wasn't that his heart wasn't in the right place. He's just, some people just don't write well. And it doesn't make any difference what you do. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they aren't going to change. And so that was sort of fun. The other thing I did at times was I did some communication training for Extension Homemakers, both at state level and also a couple times at the county level. I remember one time I always tried to be interesting, you know. You know, all good teachers are supposed to make their lessons interesting, right?
Yes.
And so I was in Pendleton, and it was a group from Umatilla, and this is when, oh, what was his name? Richard Simmons was sort of big, you know. I mean, you know, and so I started my lesson, but sort of the way he would. I'm not sure the homemakers appreciated it.
This is a guy who did, he was
exercise. But it was fun to try.
You had mentioned that you had worked with Alberta Johnston on the mini colleges for homemakers.
Yes.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that and what were the mini colleges?
Okay. How many years did we do it? Oh dear, I don't remember. Maybe Alberta will. The Extension Homemakers Council represented predominantly women who participated in Extension study groups. Okay, and they had a state organization, and they raised money, and they did projects, and everything like this. They had an annual meeting at Oregon State, and over the years, participation in the annual meeting declined. You know, fewer people were coming, and so they didn't. Everybody was saying, "Oh, what are we going to do?" And I don't know whose idea it was. Maybe it was Alberta's, I don't, you know, who came up with this, that we should offer a mini college, or what we wound up calling a mini college. These were non-credit, I mean, you know, there was no credit, but the women would come, they could be men, but they were 99.9% women, live in a dormitory, take classes from specialists or resident research teachers, and sort of get away in a sense. And we offered, I've forgotten how many classes. And Alberta was advisor to the council, and then became coordinator, also coordinated the first two or three mini colleges. I wrote the brochures, you know, that were sent to the women, and did whatever news coverage, you know, there was to do. And it was an amazing experience the first two or three years, because you had what we roughly categorized as serious classes in the morning. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, where you went in, I mean, these would last two to two and a half hours.
What were the topics of?
Well, it could be money management, it could be nutrition, it could be child development. There was some clothing, I think. And you did this every day. I mean, this particular class, mm-hmm. you know, it was done over 4 days. Then in the afternoon, you had a lighter class for, say, an hour and a half. And those varied in length, you know, from 2 days to 3 days. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. that could vary. And then late afternoon, what we called, what did we call them? Just for fun classes, I guess, is what we finally labeled them. And these were an hour and a half, and they could be flower arrangements, they could be, you know, how to prepare a fancy hors d'oeuvre, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. you know. I think maybe all of them, of the just for fun classes, were taught by the Extension homemakers themselves. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, they had some expertise and they would come. And we did that because adult learners are not used to sitting in a classroom for all day long. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard work. And the thing that was probably one of the things that was most satisfying was when you talk to the women, that a surprising number, it was the first time they had ever been away from their families. You know, and you think, oh, well, you know, by the 70s, you know, this was... But this group, and how important the extension study group was to them, mm-hmm. in their lives. Mm-hmm. That this was something that they valued highly. They learned a lot from. They were learning things at many colleges, but the other thing was they were growing sort of as individuals too. And finally, you know, we got up to what, 800 people, I think, maybe about that was the high point, and then it declined. And I've always blamed the School of Home Economics a little bit for the decline, because they got all upset or all concerned that the just for fun classes weren't academic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so we couldn't, they basically said you can't do that anymore. And mm-hmm. so they sort of drained the fun out of it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And attendance kept decreasing until finally it died.
It died.
Or we killed it. I'm not sure what it was. I always regretted that because it was a good program. Mm-hmm. It really was. Mm-hmm. And I think very valuable to those who came. I'm not even sure the council, I guess it still exists. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, over the years you must have seen these changes in the programs for women. I mean, I'm thinking in relation to like the women's movement and the women's place in society, and so the Extension Service, did it reflect any of those things?
Probably. That's a hard thing to say, or because what was done with the Extension Home Economics programs basically depended on the specialists. I mean, what areas you had specialists in. Mm-hmm. You know, and so at one point we had somebody in clothing and textiles, home management and housing, or home furnishings and housing, family life, management, which included money, mm-hmm. and foods and nutrition. How could I forget foods and nutrition? And so the lessons being offered were developed by the specialists or by the county agents, but then reviewed by the specialists. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of defined the parameters, mm-hmm. you know, a lot. I'm sure it changed. One of the things we did, or that was done, I shouldn't say we did, that was done was Women's Financial Network. Was that what it was called? Anyway, there was a special program for women that dealt with money. And this was co-sponsored with, I think it was AARP, as it was known as then, the American Association of Retired Persons. And it was to try to teach, I think it went over 6 weeks, once a week for 6 weeks, if I recall correctly. And what it was an effort to try to teach women about finances. Because a surprise, even though, you know, the modern woman knows all these things, a surprising number don't. You know, they have no idea what investments they have. They have no idea, you know, about lots of things because the husbands did it. Mm-hmm. And not all husbands shared. Mm-hmm. And what you were trying to do was to get the women to think about these things. You know, I mean, you need to know. Mm-hmm. because most women will outlive their husbands.
Yeah.
And you're gonna have to make decisions.
I think you said that one of the other areas you were most involved with was the 4-H.
Yes.
What kinds of things did you do with or for the 4-H?
Yeah. Well, that was a lot of news writing for 4-H. For instance, we used to do results stories from State Fair. Who got blue ribbons, who got red ribbon. And I did that for 25 years. It's a long time to go to State Fair. And our office was upstairs in the balcony in the 4-H building, and it would get very hot. A few times I worked directly with the kids, the young people, doing workshops on community development sorts of things called community pride programs, that's what they were called. And this was sponsored by Chevron, and it gave small grants of money, 200, 300, 500 was probably a lot, to 4-H clubs to do community service, and they did things like cemetery, cleanups and beautification projects in various places in the community, et cetera, et cetera. And what we were trying to do was get them to tell people what they were doing. Don't just take the money and do, but also tell.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to for many years, National 4-H Council organized what was called the National 4-H Congress, which was always held in Chicago. And each state, there were sponsored trips. Like Coates and Clark would send one person from each state in clothing. Somebody else, Simplicity, I think, or somebody did one person from each state for style review. So there were rewards, and the award was a trip to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And at Congress, like six in each area or eight, would also be declared national winners and would get like $1,000 college scholarships. And I was fortunate to go with the Oregon delegation to Congress the first time I went. Oh dear, I don't remember when. Maybe 1970, 71. And it was incredible. it was simply incredible. We went to ballets. We had Arthur Fiedler conducting the Cleveland Symphony, and all these things. And the dinners were incredible. You had six pieces of silverware on each side. I mean, it was a real show. After that. That was probably the highlight, or one of the highlights. But after that, I went back to Congress, four or five times maybe, and worked on the press committee, and was somewhat involved with the Oregon delegates. But gradually it became less and less. The cost became higher, and pretty soon it was down to where the Purdue Glee Club was the big attraction. And then they stopped it.
Mm-hmm.
It died. Probably correctly. And now it was revived as sort of a, I guess, I'm not sure what they do. It got revived, and it's been in Atlanta, and it's been in Memphis, and I don't know where it is now. I mean, it's been, moving around a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, they were fun. And one of the things that I did was always write the stories about who was going.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And one of the things you wanted to make sure, or I always wanted to make sure anyway, that the donors were listed, because you didn't want the taxpayers thinking their money was being spent, you know, to send kids on this trip to Chicago. 4-H gave me my first trip to Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. When I went back, there was a program called National 4-H Conference. And each state could send four young people. And so one year they decided that they were going to have information people come and do things, you know, press releases or whatever. And so I was the one from the West, and it was one of the most exciting trips I've ever had. Mm-hmm. I was old enough that I thought I probably never would go to Washington, you know. And then I did, and I went with the 4-H'ers on their tours around the city and to mm-hmm. the monuments, and mm-hmm. you know, I'm sort of bouncing up and down saying, it's real. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was incredible. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time the four kids from Oregon, a couple of them, it was the first time they'd ever flown. And they started talking about getting sick.
Oh, dear.
And I was sitting beside one of them. And I thought, shut up, you know. I mean, don't do this. And sure enough, they talked themselves into getting airsick.
What year was that? Was that, do you remember?
Oh. 64, maybe. Somewhere in there.
What about some changes that in the 4-H? Like, I'm thinking about moving into urban areas.
Okay. Oregon always claimed that we were the first state to have 4-H in an urban area. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we were ever challenged. But I think it's true, because 4-H went into the city of Portland in World War I.
Okay.
With the Victory Gardens. And have been there ever since. Well, until Multnomah County withdrew its funding 2-3 years ago. And it was a very interesting situation, because for many, many years, you had two extension offices in Multnomah County. One in Gresham, which was 4-H, Ag, Home Ec, you know, all the stuff. And one in the city of Portland, the old Cooch School, which is now part of the Portland State campus. I mean that. And there were two 4-H agents there, and they worked in the city. They didn't work in the county, they worked in the city. Dwayne Johnson was one of the ones out at Gresham for a long time. And eventually they merged, you know. But the funding, the Portland School District actually gave us money for, oh, I don't know, it must have been at least 60 years, if not longer. Then that stopped when their budgets fell apart too, you know. But for a long time you had, and that was unique as far as I know, at least in Oregon, mm-hmm. Where a school district was actually, budgeting. Mm-hmm. For 4-H, and went to support the city of Portland office. Mm-hmm. And it was not a huge amount of money, but it was nice, mm-hmm. you know, to have. And then you must admit we were pretty much white, you know, I mean, which reflected Oregon. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest changes came, well, let's back up to Home Ec for a second. In about 1980, I think, was when Home Economics had a program going called Young Homemakers. It was for young women. And the decision was made that we should translate English into Spanish and the materials. And one of the things we did was, I did, was to go out and find, I found, I think, four newspapers to help. And we were providing them a column every month in Spanish, which they were running. And we did this for, 3, 4, 5 years, or longer. The newspaper column,
And when did this start? When did you?
I think sometime in the 80s. I'm terrible at dates. I remember events, but I don't remember dates always. But that was sort of the first time I think that Extension had tried to translate things, I mean, on a systematic basis. Mm-hmm. At about that same time, there was some movement on the agriculture side to provide training in Spanish for agricultural laborers, particularly in the application of pesticides, herbicides. Mm-hmm. Then in 4-H, 4-H went around and around on what to do, in a sense. We were working with blacks, African Americans, whatever, in Portland pretty well. I mean, not superbly, but pretty well. But it was the growing Latino population that probably was the biggest puzzle to us. Do you translate all the 4-H materials in Spanish? Do you translate part of them into Spanish? We had 2 or 3 extension agents who went on sabbatical in Central America to study Spanish. I mean, that was the primary reason they were down there. Because they had growing Latino populations in their counties. And it was hard, and I think one of the things that finally developed in 4-H was that you didn't need to translate the member materials, the materials that the kids, the young people themselves were getting. Because almost all of them were going to school, they read English, they could understand English. I mean, this was not a foreign language. But it was easier for the parents if you translated material for them. Not because they couldn't read English, but at that time, I mean, this is several years ago, it was simply easier for them to understand what you were trying to do. Mm-hmm. Since I retired, 4-H has done all sorts of programming and special programming and unique programming for Latino youth.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of retiring, you're still connected with the 4-H, with the 4-H Foundation?
Yes, yes.
With Alberta?
Yeah, I'm a trustee of the Oregon 4-H Foundation.
Okay, how long have you been on the board?
Probably since about 1996, 97.
And what kinds of things do you do, or does the board?
I go to
do
meetings and vote. supposedly, we're supposed to try to help raise money, and the donations to the foundation just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Some of the things, I think, in a way, I think 4-H lives on its past reputation. People have very fond, it's amazing, people who were truly involved with 4-H as youngsters, I mean, for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, a lot of them have very, very fond memories of that time, who their leaders were, what their projects were, what they learned. Some have kept their 4-H record books, for 50 years. It was a very important part of their lives.
What does the foundation spend the money on, then? What are your major projects?
Well, our major project's been the 4-H Center for many years.
Okay.
That's now been sort of spun off into its... It now has its own board of directors and is its own entity. But it's still related to the foundation.
Hey, Dan, it's Wendelin. I'm not... You don't need to call me back. I'm just reporting in that I haven't forgotten that I said I would talk to Steve Gordon or others about the water study. And I haven't reached